You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, Spycast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about Spycast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make Spycast better, and you can help. For the final time, I will say we are joined today by Dr. Andrew Hammond, the new and incoming historian and curator of the International Spy Museum. I am moving on to new opportunities elsewhere. I will still be probably quite heavily involved with the museum. But for now, let me take this chance to introduce to you my replacement, historian number five in the long lineage. I would say that, you know, long and distinguished, but let's not get ahead of ourselves. Lineage of spy museum historians, Dr. Andrew Hammond. He has his PhD in diplomatic history from the University of Warwick, where he took a deep dive into U.S. policy in Afghanistan from 1979 until today. He is also a veteran of the Royal Air Force, where he worked in several different intelligence-related capacities. He comes to us after finishing a stint as a fellow at the Library of Congress, and before that, 2 years as a Mellow Public Humanities Fellow at the National September 11th Memorial Museum. There's a lot more to Andrew, but that's why we're here, so we'll let the conversation draw those things out. So welcome, Andrew. Welcome to the museum. Welcome to the job. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us here at Spycast.
Thanks, Vince. I should point out that it was Mellon Fellow, not Mellow Fellow, but I will take Mellow Fellow.
You know what? Mellow sounds good. We haven't done one of these in person in a while. Mellon Public Humanities Fellow. There you go. They should call it the Mellow Fellow. That'd be even better.
Exactly.
I'll write him a letter.
Exactly.
So let's start in not in chronological order. Let's go out of chronological order for a little bit. I want to talk to you about grad school, because when I entered grad school, I had a general idea of what I wanted to study. I knew I wanted to study kind of the confluence of nuclear weapons and intelligence. But beyond that, you know, I went in there with high hopes and changed my very specific subject multiple times before I finally landed on what I wrote my dissertation on. So I want to know what got you interested in U.S. foreign policy, in CIA and intelligence policy, and of course, why Afghanistan? Or kind of walk us through that path that many people out there who are grad students today are probably experiencing that real time as we speak.
Okay. Well, thanks for the kind introduction. And I'm thrilled to be starting at the Spy Museum. So grad school, how did I end up studying what I'm studying? So basically it goes back to a dark room on September the 11th, 2001. I was in the dark room. My colleague came and said to me, "You have to see what's happened." I thought to myself, okay, here we go. It's going to be some banal thing. He looked really ashen. I was like, what the heck is going on? I walked through to a room where we had BBC News on, just running constantly in the background. And the first tower had been struck. So we're there watching this TV. I'm in this G2 intelligence section at the time. And then the next thing, the second terror struck. So at that moment, I guess we all knew in one way or another that our lives would be affected. For me, it led to a really deep desire to try to understand where that event came from. Like, I guess I used to joke with my students that my academic career began with a WTF question. What the heck is going on? How did this happen? And to me, the most powerful route into that was through history, was through the study of the past. I've always been a lover of history, but history helped me to contextualize and understand that event. So I was actually in Germany at the time. So for military history buffs like us, it was a fascinating place to be. It was the former headquarters of the British Army of the Rhine. It was the former headquarters of RAF Germany, of the 2nd Allied Tactical Air Force, of the Northern Army Group. I was there, obviously, after the Cold War ended, but it was still a fascinating place to be and to think about all the history that had preceded me being there. And one of the great things about that post was that the library there, because it was a number of different headquarters, and at the time the ARC was there, the Allied Rapid Reaction Corps, so the headquarters library was phenomenal, and I basically just consumed everything I could get my hands on to try to work out what was going on in the world. And ultimately, it led to me leaving the service in 2005, just because this kind of desire to understand, it was almost like a sickness. Mm-hmm. It was almost like something I couldn't turn off. And I'm sure I would have had a very happy and fulfilling career if I had have stayed in the Royal Air Force. But it came to that stage where I thought, you only get one chance at life. You should do what really compels you and drives you. So I went back to school. And from there, I have been on the journey that has led me here today. So my PhD topic was really a way to put 9/11 in a much deeper historical context. So I compared and contrasted the Soviet-Afghan war with the war on terror, and 9/11 was the pivot. So really, sometimes I think about this, that period between the North Tower being struck and the South Tower being struck, it was almost like this moment that people at the time did not know that they were living through, but the tectonic plates of right. world politics and of world history were shifting beneath our feet, and the realization that they had shifted only happened when that second tower was struck. So for me, it was really a way to answer this kind of deeper question about what was going on in the world.
Well, I mean, this is recent history. I mean, we both lived through it. I mean, most of people listening to this lived through it as well. I mean, we do have some younger listeners, but I guess the scary part now is you could be essentially in college and go, what, 9/11? I don't remember that. Were you worried when you started that you'd run into classification issues? You'd run into issues of people not willing to talk to you, since some of it's oral history involved in this. But, you know, even with my topic, doing nuclear weapons policy, moving into the 1960s and even late 50s, you run into classification issues. You're dealing with the 2000s. You're dealing with the 90s. The most ancient you're going essentially is 79, right? So is this something that kind of you saw as a potential roadblock going in?
Yes, I did. I guess like most graduate students, there was a degree of naivety. I mean, I knew that a lot of stuff would not be accessible. But do you know what? I think that is one of the things that I find fascinating about studying intelligence, you know, the wilderness of mirrors. how can we surmount or get around or work within the constraints that there are when you study intelligence? So even for people that are studying stuff that happened 50 years ago, 70 years ago, there are still problems. When you're looking at the late 1970s, the early 80s, there's obviously more problems. So I guess I had some idea that there would be issues there, but I just tried to come up with creative solutions to get around it. So formal research, the Carter administration, there was more stuff than there was for Reagan. With Reagan, there was more stuff than there was for H.W. Bush, and so on down to the present day. So I just had to think, how can I get around this? And ultimately, what were the questions that I was trying to address? Some of them relied on information that was in the archives. Some of the other questions could be answered in different ways or through different routes. So, as you mentioned, one of them was by speaking to people that were involved as a way to try to get around some of those problems.
This is a bit of a meta question, but whatever, we'll deal with it. Was there a worry, or is there still a worry, that it's not quote-unquote history yet, that really we haven't had enough time to digest it, particularly the people that you're talking to, right? You want, how did you feel on this day? Well, maybe we know that, but have we had the chance to kind of really think about it? I mean, the poli-sci people are like, yes, if it was last week, we've got plenty of time to think about it. Historians, we want to ruminate a little longer. We want to kind of see, if the Afghan war ended in 2005, it'd be a whole other issue. But the fact that we're still there and it's still not a solution, we still don't know what's going to happen. Is there a worry that you're kind of, you know, getting across your lane a little bit into the political science realm or into the international relations realm and not as much on the history side?
Okay. Yeah, a good question. I think for me, so my undergrad was in history and political science, although I mainly focused on international relations. There definitely was a sense of using both of those subjects. In terms of my specific topic matter, I mean, this is a bigger question. What constitutes history, right? When I was in the Air Force, I actually done this Open University course, mainly focusing on ancient history. And we looked at Herodotus, Thucydides, Xenophon. So people that are routinely called, depending on who you ask, the father or the fathers of history. And they done what would now be classified as contemporary history, or some people would even say political science. Of course, I would never compare myself to any of those figures, but if it was good enough for them, you know, if speaking to people as a way to access information about the past was a good methodology for them, I was happy to deal with it too. Or we can even go more recently, look at A.G.P. Taylor's book on the Second World War. Mm-hmm. That was written barely 30 years afterwards. That was a landmark book in the Second World War. Again, if it was good enough for A.G.P. Taylor, it was good enough for me. I think that for myself, the way that I approach questions of intelligence or questions of the past are just, I guess, problem-driven rather than process-driven. So what's the question that I'm asking of the world? If that means that I am looking at stuff that happened 300 years ago where you just can't speak to anyone that existed then, so be it. If it's something that happened last week, so be it. If it's something that happened, you know, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, so be it. So for me, it's less driven by the process and more driven by the question. But I would, you know, again, anybody that says it's not history, I would say, look at Thucydides, look at A.G.P. Taylor. And if they're not historians, I don't know who is.
Right. So your dissertation, your congratulations, it's being turned into a book that's coming out sometime soon. Can you give a little information on that? How much did you have to tweak it to turn it into, now it's a university press, so it probably wasn't tweaked all that much. But, you know, dissertations are very dry on purpose. How much did you have to make it accessible to the public, at least the academic public?
Yeah, I think that this is a question that anybody that's finished their PhD that wants to turn it into a book has to face. How do you de-thesisize it? And how do you get out of that mode of thinking that you have been badgered and cajoled into? Because that style of thinking is good and it's important, but it doesn't necessarily make for a great monograph. It doesn't make for a great book. So for me, to be honest, I ended up losing about 50,000 words. So at the beginning, you know, I was, because of the nature of my dissertation, it ended up involving me reading a lot of different literatures. So it wasn't very clean and neat. Here's this gap, here's this area I'm addressing, here's this one body of literature. Okay, that's it, it's all neat. It ended up being quite messy in some ways, and a lot of the dissertation was just trying to make sense of that mess. And a lot of that, I guess, it reminded me of doing fractions as a kid. So when you do fractions, the teacher wants to see how you got to the figure that you've arrived at. How have you done all the work?
Right, show your work.
Exactly. Right. Long division. Yeah. So a lot of the beginning of the PhD was just showing my work. Here's how I got to where I got to. But for a book, you know, that's kind
right,
of not
and
necessary.
One of my advantages was there was almost no historiography in my topic, which meant I didn't have to like waste the first like 70 pages of my dissertation talking about all this stuff. And so that was very easy to do. But when you have so much that's been written about just by itself, just the CIA in Afghanistan in the 1980s, and then of course after 9/11 and everything else, that had to have been, you kind of had the opposite problem I did, where I had literally had zero things to look at except for one or two very badly written books. You had just this deluge. You had the fire hose. I had the trickle.
Yeah, and both of them present their own problems. Right. And for any grad students that are listening, that's part of that's part of the trick of getting to where you need to go to. What's the particular situation that I am facing? Is it a deluge or is it a trickle? And what are the particular problems that are involved in that? And how do I get to where I need to get to? And that can take years, of course, to get through all of that.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of cases, like I'm sure in your case, it was like there's hundreds and hundreds of things written on this, but how they missed this very straightforward basic issue that you kind of, where's that gap that you focused on? For me, it was like, why is no one looking at this? And you kind of, you both are in a position where I was in disbelief. I'm like, someone has to have written this already. Someone has to have done this already. And I'm sure, again, you probably were thinking the same thing, like, is this my birthday? I mean, it's like, how has no one written what is kind of one of the most obvious things?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, so we've been speaking about some of the challenges of this of research and of making sense of all the information, but I'm sure you would agree with me here. There's a real thrill in dealing with information that no one's really looked at before, or looking at documents in a new way or through a fresh lens. I remember, so the first time I had a fellowship at the Library of Congress was in 2011, and I remember looking through the papers of William Odom, and he was the director of the NSA back in the 80s, but before that, he was the military attaché to Brzezinski, Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, and I remember coming across some of his record cards, and he didn't write one for every day, but for important days, he had written a record card. And I remember coming across one group of the record cards with an elastic band that was frayed and molding. And it was obvious because as soon as I touched it, it fell apart. So it was obvious that nobody had looked at this before. And I remember opening that up with my hands literally shaking with excitement. And I came across the record card for the 25th of December 1979, which was the day that the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. And I remember just being so thrilled to come across this. And I guess just to go back to one of your earlier questions, if the information is not in the National Archives or at the Presidential Libraries, one of the interesting things to do is just to think laterally, well, how can I get around this? Right. Or how can I access interesting information that doesn't necessarily lie in an NSC memo or something?
Well, I mean, I had to do that several times. I mean, positions where people wrote letters that involved, for instance, how much plutonium you need to get critical mass, right? That's still classified, right? You're never, you know, there's a letter that lays that out that you're never going to see. No, none of us are going to see. Our kids aren't going to see it. Our grandkids aren't going to see it. But 20 people wrote about the letter. And so essentially you can find what the letter says in 20 different letters other places. Mm-hmm. I still don't know the exact number, so don't get on me about that. But I know everything else that was in that letter, which is really what I was looking for mm-hmm. in the first place. But I had a similar experience where I was in the microfilm for some of these old documents, and there were areas within the microfilm that they clearly had pulled up stuff. Here's a classification. And I realized when I looked at it closely, no one else had done this. When I looked at it closely, they pulled it out in 1972. And I don't know, I'm probably not the last person to look at the microfilm, but I'm the first person to look at the microfilm and go, this was classified in 1972. I wonder if it's still classified in 2012 or whatever year it was. And so when I went, and they're like, it shouldn't be. So FOIA requests later, all of a sudden I have all this stuff no one's ever seen. And in that case, it was the handwritten personal notes of the guy who cleared everybody for the Manhattan Project.
Wow.
Like, basically, it's, you know, if anyone's on a security clearance, there's a guy who sits there and asks you all these questions. It's his handwritten notes from them. And I'm like, Yahtzee, right? I mean, I found something that probably no one had looked at since the people were cleared for the Manhattan Project. So that wasn't my focus, but it was a cool little thing I could add to the process. When it comes to the book, though, when is it coming out, number one? Number two, were you able, between the time that you wrote your dissertation, which is now a couple of years ago, and actually the book, are you already like wanting to like write a coda to it? Like, is there already enough stuff that's happened in Afghanistan and with U.S. foreign policy that you already like want to change the ending a little bit?
I don't want to change the ending. I think that the overall conclusions that I get to still hold. But the current administration, presidential administration, has been a little bit of an outlier in various ways. So I think that that's something that I'm going to have to address. In terms of when it's coming out next year. It's with Edinburgh University Press, who have actually written, you know, actually quite a few interesting books on intelligence have came out with them in the past few years. They're building up a good catalogue, and it's going to be released in hardback and paperback, but the overall conclusions are still the same. But I will just address some of the stuff that's happened in between, but it's not a kind of it's not a foreign affairs article where at the end I have policy prescriptions and right. You know, here's what's happened. It's more of a, you know, even looking, comparing and contrasting the Soviet-Afghan war with the war on terror, even both of them I try to place within a broader reading of American history. So it's not just, okay, the clock has started in 1979. I try to contextualize both of them within the Cold War, and then I try to contextualize the Cold War within America's strategic trajectory since really the foundation of the Republic, right. from 13 colonies with a tenuous foothold on the eastern seaboard to a transcontinental superpower that, you know, yeah, we don't need to get into any more, but, you know, if you want to know the world at present, it's helpful to study the United States.
Hey everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
That was a wonderful euphemism you used, saying that the current administration is somewhat of an outlier. I know you're talking specifically about Afghan policy, but yes. Let me ask you about your time in the Royal Air Force, because you were involved in several capacities doing intelligence work. Was this always the idea of joining the RAF and doing intel work, or was there an idea of joining the RAF and doing other things?
I think that there was an idea of joining the RAF more generally. I used to work next to someone who's in the Royal Air Force, and they spoke to me about it, and I was always interested in it. I was always interested in the military. My mother's two uncles, both of them died in the Second World War. One of them is buried in Yokohama in Japan. He was captured at the fall of Hong Kong on Christmas Day 1941. The other one is buried now in Chittagong in Bangladesh. And I've always wanted to go. I've still never managed to do it. I've always wanted to go to put some flowers down at their graves, because no one with a blood connection, as far as I know, has ever been there to pay their respects. So I guess for me, I was born in 1974. And it might sound weird to some any younger listeners, but it was interesting the way that the Second World War was still the backdrop against which I grew up, the toys I played with, right, the comics I read, the movies I watched. So I guess there was always an interest in the military. There was an interest in the Royal Air Force specifically, because of the person that I used to work next to. And then in terms of intelligence, it was, you know, I guess it was like most boys, I guess there was always an interest in that as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those fun things where you think, you know, 30 years ago from now is basically the end of the Cold War, right? So I remember the wall coming, very, very clearly remember the wall coming down. Well, you and I were born 30 years after the end of World War II. So for those, yeah, it's one of these, you don't think of it that way, right? I mean, World War II seems like so long ago, but for even people in their 40s and 50s, you know, when we were born, so like our age when we were born had a memory of the Second World War. And that is, you know, one of those kind of things where you have to kind of retell that to yourself, that the history is not that ancient. I mean, we're at the point now where it's getting pretty ancient when you have a 75th anniversary this year of the end of the war. So there aren't a whole lot of people who are still alive, but we're now aging ourselves and talking about, you know, 40 plus years ago, it was, there's still relatively young people who had even fought in the Second World War. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about your museum work, because I think this kind of ties directly into that concept and that question of experience and other things. You did some oral history for your dissertation and for your degree. You probably did a lot more when you ended up at museum, particularly at the 9/11 museum. Oral history is something that some people love, some people hate. It's poo-pooed by some. You obviously have to take it with a grain of salt, because you're talking to somebody who has a dog in the fight in giving you the best version of themselves. Did you learn a lot more about oral history when you were at, particularly like the 9/11 museum about, because I mean, that's going to come in handy here too. You never know who's going to walk through the door at this museum, you know, and we've done now, for anyone who's been to the New Spy Museum, there are dozens and dozens of films throughout the museum. And part of what I spent time doing when we were opening was interviewing all these people that ended up in these films. And to me, that was one of the most fascinating things I've ever done, is kind of sitting down and saying, all right, we may not use all of this, and you know, a two-hour interview turned into a three-minute film inside the museum, but we're going to talk about everything anyway. And just getting a chance to kind of be with the person, watching them reminisce, watching them in some cases talking about things they haven't talked about in a long time. Is that something that, you know, you really focused on a lot during the 9/11 museum time period?
Yeah, so when I was at the 9/11 museum, I guess the first thing to say was that it was uncanny that my academic career really began on 9/11, as I mentioned earlier. And then as a Mellon Fellow there, I had a desk that overlooked Ground Zero. So for someone with an interest in history, it was very uncanny to be there looking at it every day. And the project that I was working on when I was there, alongside doing stuff with the museum, was trying to tell the story of 9/11 and the war on terror through the stories and voices of veterans of the military and intelligence communities. So if any listeners have ever came across Studs Terkel's great book, The Good War, An Oral History of World War II, in some ways I was trying to do that for 9/11 and the War on Terror. So the story of these events is told by presidents, by journalists, by many different types of people. So I guess it was just a pretty humble attempt to say, well, let's see how the people that, you know, were involved in these events, how did they make sense of them? How did they live through these events? So that's what I was working on when I was at the 9/11 Museum, mainly interviewing veterans of those wars and trying to understand how they made sense of them and get a sense of their own stories. I think with oral history, you're right, some people are a little bit sniffy about it. Again, I would use the example of people like Thucydides and Herodotus. But in some ways, it depends what types of questions you're asking, right? And it depends what type of a historian you are. So let's say, for example, you're a political historian. Maybe you're going to pay more attention to the government archives. If you're a cultural historian, maybe you have to look at different places for your information. If you're an oral historian, think of how liberating that is in some ways. Here are all these people who never left any trace behind, who are not in the archives, who maybe were illiterate and never wrote letters, who were marginalized by society. So oral history grew out of that. Let's speak to people who historians traditionally ignored. But I think that it's also great just for getting information that doesn't exist in any archive, even if they are a Secretary of State. Maybe there's stuff that they haven't left behind in the archives, and the only way to get to that information is to speak to them. So to me, oral history is interesting on a factual level. You can find out stuff that doesn't exist anywhere else, but also on a subjective level about people's identity. How did they make sense of these events? How did they understand the world around them? What was their operating software, if you want to put it like that? Like, what was the cultural filter through which they were making sense of the information that they were dealing with on a daily basis?
It's good that you're for oral history, because essentially that's what this is. It's a recorded oral history. So if you're like, oh, oral history sucks, I'm like, oh man, we hired the wrong guy. One of the things I learned as I was here at the museum that I didn't learn is the wrong word. One of the things I began to appreciate a lot more being here at the museum was the power of objects. You know, I'd been to museums, particularly like Air and Space here in D.C., and just ate it up because I was an Air and Space nerd growing up, and just seeing, you know, Chuck Yeager's Bell X-1 or Apollo 11 or other things like that. And just never really kind of took that next step understanding why those things mattered so much to me. You're now in a museum where there's a lot of objects that have some interesting backgrounds. But the 9/11 Museum, you had some extraordinary, they have extraordinary objects there. Was that something that you kind of understood going in, or was there a better appreciation as you were there to seeing how objects can tell a story without even a label, without anyone talking about them, just by being there themselves?
Absolutely. So I had a sense of the power of objects before I went in there. So back was when I was an undergrad, I done an internship and Glasgow Museums, so my home city. So I had a bit of an appreciation about the power of objects from that experience. But at the 9/11 Museum, you know, we're dealing with a very emotive event, something where objects can literally move people to tears. So it was certainly impressed on me much more there how powerful objects were. And I think one of the things that I underlined was, unfortunately, in the academy, we're quite often sent off into these paths that we are sort of pushed down. So historians, they deal with documents. You know, they don't speak to people anymore. They did originally, but they just deal with documents. It's objects. Okay, that's for the archaeologists. You know, you go and sit and speak to people, or that's for the anthropologists. What happens if you just reject that disciplining process and you just say, what questions do I want to ask of the world? And then where does the information to answer those questions lie? And I guess that's the way that I try to approach it. And one of the most powerful objects that I have ever came across was a sword that was forged from World Trade Center steel. So I was at this event. I was invited to this veterans event in the Villages in Florida, and it was an event for veterans who were struggling with mental health, with other issues, and one of the most profound and humbling parts of that whole weekend was they brought out what they termed the Spartan sword. So this sword forged from World Trade Center steel. All of the veterans, they either touched the sword or they touched someone who was touching the sword, and then they made an oath not to take their own lives unless they had spoken to their battle buddy first. And I've got it on video, and it's a very moving and profound encounter. But think about it. You know, at one level, a piece of steel is a piece of steel is a piece of steel, but it's the meaning that people give to the steel. And I'm sure you've got, you know, 1,000 stories, having been here for a number of years, about the power of objects that you just can't get across in words or documents.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you sometimes just see people's jaws drop and just staring, and like, the label's not that long, like, what do you've probably read it 30 times by now, but no, it's just they're kind of thinking about what they're looking at, kind of the history behind what they're seeing. So you talked about the academy, and you talked about kind of the military side of things, the intelligence side of things. A lot of things can be done with a history PhD, despite what my mom thought. You are now, by your decision to work here, you're basically a museum professional. You can run away from it if you want to, but that's what you've decided to do. I'm in the same boat. You know, we can all kind of go in a different direction, but you're now a museum professional. So let me ask you the question that perhaps this is the toss-up, but it's a question that I haven't asked yet. Why here? Like, why is this the job that you focused on? Because your resume, I mean, a little inside baseball listeners, we had dozens apply to this job. And Andrew, like, is the last lone survivor of all of this. And the reason is because he could do lots of things with his background and with what he has on his resume. So what made you choose this as what you wanted to do for the next several years?
Okay. I mean, there's a number of parts to that. I guess one part would be the job advertisement was perfectly suited to my skill set. So that's, I guess that's the most obvious answer to the question. The second part was, to me, intelligence and espionage are such a fascinating window into much bigger questions. So, I'm interested in intelligence history. I'm interested in modern history, but I'm also interested in just the human story more generally. How did we get here to where we are? How did we split the atom and get to the stage where we could bring about our own destruction? So if you look in that broader timeline, history, intelligence is such an interesting part of that story. And Christopher Andrews' great book a couple of years ago, The Secret World, he looks at that broad sweep. But through the lens of intelligence and espionage, you can look at military history. You can look at, Hannibal found out from some people that the Lake Trasimene got really foggy in the morning, and he used that to spring a trap and destroy a Roman army. So we can look at the whole sweep of history by looking at intelligence or espionage. We can also look at politics. We can look at political systems, political institutions. We can look at ethics. How should we act? How should we be governed? You can use it to look at culture. Let's look at spy fiction. Let's look at spy movies, The Americans, Homeland. You can use it to look at, say, American society. So we can look at gender relations, we can look at race, we can look at class, and so forth. So I guess for me, the subject matter is a great window into so much other stuff. And in terms of the Spy Museum specifically, other than the fact that it played to my strengths, when I was at the 9/11 Museum, I realised the power of museums to get people to engage with the past, the power of museums as a source of historical literacy, to understand the world, and it's a way to reach a broader audience and a way to just have a different experience, I guess.
So let me ask you one last question, and then we'll wrap things up. And this is one I'm not going to hold you to, but just asking you to predict.
Okay.
So in the next couple of years, I'm wondering if you can think of what kind of topics you might have to deal with in the future here at the Spy Museum. Things that, you know, you could say cyber, and the guy, that's cheating a little bit. Like, what do you foresee as being kind of the major intelligence topics moving forward in the next couple of years?
Okay. I think some of the major intelligence topics would be looking at maybe focusing a little bit more on the international aspect of the International Spy Museum. So within intelligence studies, the group of people that study intelligence, historians, political scientists, and so forth. Within intelligence studies, there's moves to look at different countries to get away from the Anglosphere. So I think internationalizing it would be one part of it. I think artificial intelligence, I think technological developments are just so fascinating but so scary as well. You could think about, getting beyond the state in terms of looking at intelligence. Who is collecting so much information about us now? It's not necessarily the CIA, it's Google, it's Apple, it's Whole Foods. It's you can look at somebody's consumption habits and make pretty good estimations of their level of education, their their longevity even. So I think that those types of questions will be fascinating. Artificial intelligence. What if you can get a chip put in your body that will detect proteins that are released when you get a heart attack? Now, on one level, why would you not want to get advance warning of a heart attack? On another level, that's really scary as well. So there's a brave new world of intelligence, and technology is obviously an important part of that story. And the technology is not standing still. It's constantly changing and evolving, and we're all going to have to be on our toes to keep up with what's going on.
Well, Andrew, thank you for taking the time to talk to us here today. I wish you all the best of luck and all the good fortune moving forward as a historian and curator and host of SpyCast. For those of you who have been listening for, you know, whether it's a month or years, it's been a lot of fun doing this. I imagine I will be a guest on the podcast once or twice moving into the future, but this is my final time signing off. So I'd like to thank... he can edit this out if he wants to, but both Mike Mincy and Memphis Vaughn are AV extraordinaires for years of hard work making sure these podcasts get done. They're going to make sure that Andrew is up and running and ready to rock moving forward. And everyone else that's been involved in helping me do this podcast, because no one the hell knows what they're doing when they walk into this job. And so, I mean, Andrew's now understanding that and realizing that. And it's just kind of, you make it up as you go along. And I think it's been a lot of fun along the way. And you'll hear from me again out there. I can't really be too open and public about what I'm doing next, but it won't take long before you hear where I've landed. So, Andrew, appreciate the time. Listeners out there of SpyCast, I appreciate all of you listening for so long. And see y'all later. The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit. If you want to donate to the museum, or if you're local and want to volunteer at the museum, please visit our website at spymuseum.org for more information.